Father, we thank you for all that you will say to us this morning. And I pray that you would fill us by your Spirit. Fill each of us as we listen, fill me as I speak. And would you speak by your Spirit into our hearts through these words. Amen. Well, 2 weeks ago, we met Job in the land of Uz, or Uz. I said Uz till I saw that video. We don't know exactly where it was, somewhere in the east, possibly in the land of Edom, but it's definitely not Israel. And if I need my clicker. Thanks, Martin. Is that working? Oh, there we are. That is working. Job is called blameless and upright. By the narrator and by God himself twice. And we also saw last week how Job is really blameless, how Satan has real influence, but he isn't God's equal. God is supreme and sovereign. And we saw how God gives Satan terrible permission to inflict harm on Job, but not why. And despite the terrible things that happened to him, we saw that Job refused to do no wrong twice. At the end of chapter 1, at the end of chapter 1 and then halfway through chapter 2. The question is, will Job prove to be a real believer? Now, as I did last week, I encourage you to go home and read the wider passages from Job. Each week we have quite a big chunk of the book that the preacher's going to speak on, but we won't have all of it read every week. So we stopped after 7 verses of chapter 3 this morning, but I will be speaking about the rest of that chapter as well. And I encourage you to read through it yourself during the week. It may be that it's helpful to read the whole book all in one go. It may be that you find it more helpful to read it section by section. If you're like me, you probably will need to read it multiple times to start getting your head around what's going on. But one question I didn't address last week is this. Does Satan still do this today to Christians? The answer is yes and no. Yes, Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter tells us that the devil prowls around God's people like a ravenous lion, a roaring lion. And Paul encourages us in Ephesians 6 to put on the armour of God. Why? So we can resist the devil's schemes. He is still a dangerous enemy, and he does still have terrible permissions. But also, no. We live in a world now after the cross, on which Jesus, in Colossians 2, Paul says, triumphed over the powers of evil. In Revelation 12, there's this wonderful picture of a colossal battle between God and a great dragon, which stands for Satan. And the great dragon is defeated in verse 11 by the blood of the Lamb, which has already been shed on the cross. So what that means is Satan might still accuse, but God isn't listening. And God's people don't need to listen either, because there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Romans 8 verse 1. In a way, we are far more blessed than Job because we live this side of the cross. And it's important to see how the deep truths of the cross help us to understand and apply some of these difficult passages, particularly in the Old Testament, to us today. It's a really important way of making sure we read the whole of the Bible all the way through. There are various different ways of using the Bible, though. A new vicar moved into his parish, and one Saturday he thought he'd do some pastoral visiting. And he went round to visit some of his parishioners, and all was going really well, until he came to one particular house, and he knocked on the door, and no answer. It was really obvious that someone was home, so he knocked on the door again. He kept knocking, no answer at all. So in the end, he took out his visiting card, and he wrote on the back Revelation 3:20, which says this: "Here I am, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with that person and they with me. And then he went home. And after the service the following day, he found his card that he'd left at that house on the collection plate. And under Revelation 3:20 was written this, Genesis 3 verse 10. I heard you in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. That's certainly one way to use the Bible. That is not a true story, it did not happen to me. So our passage last week, we ended our passage last week with poor old Job. He was there alone, if you remember this picture, sitting, scraping himself with a piece of broken pottery, it says in verse 8 of chapter 2, sitting among the ashes. We were sitting at the ashes yesterday, but a very different kind of ashes, the cricket kind of ashes. We had a lovely day. Job wasn't sitting playing cricket, he was sitting in a dung heap, in a rubbish heap. See, what happened was all the rubbish would be taken outside of the city or the town and it would be put in a massive pile and the pile was set on fire. So it would be sort of smouldering all the time. And it stank and it was pretty disgusting. In Jesus' day, the one outside Jerusalem was called Gehenna. And Jesus used the word Gehenna as a picture of hell. It was so disgusting. Well, that's where Job is. And so we meet his three friends in verse 11 today. Eliphaz the Temanite, Zophar the Naamathite, and the shortest man in the Bible, shorter than Nehemiah, even shorter, Bildad the Shuhite. Bildad the Shuhite? Yes. Like Job, they aren't Israelites. But they represent the best wisdom, as the video said, that the ancient world had to offer. And they don't live near each other either. These places where they're from, they're kind of across they're reasonably close, but they're sort of hundreds of miles apart. And there were no emails or phones in those days. So imagine how long it must have taken for them to hear about what had happened to Job, and then communicate with one another, to work out what they were going to do. And then it says in verse 11, they set out from their homes and met together, and then they travelled to Job. So this is not the next day. Don't want you to think that they all heard on the phone, oh, Job's not very well. Joanne didn't phone them and say, oh, so-and-so's very well, can we go and see them in hospital? That's not what happened. It took many months. In fact, in Job 7 verse 3, Job complains about the months of futility that he'd been suffering. So there are these friends, and they are good friends. So the word there, we often use the word friend. It's kind of, I think, been cheapened a bit today, partly by social media, where really we use the word friend often to mean acquaintance. But the word here means much more than that. It's used in Proverbs 18 to describe someone closer than a brother. In 2 Samuel 16, David's friend, Hushai, risks his life to work inside the court of David's enemies to keep him informed about what was going on. In his book, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis writes movingly of the rare love of true friendship. And in fact, he said, this life has no better gift to give than true friendship. It's well worth reading, The Four Loves. Anyway, Job's friends, they set out from their homes, verse 11, and they travelled to see Job, and they went to see him, to go to him, to sympathise with him, and to comfort him. Now, it might sound a bit patronising to us, but that's not what was meant at all. And think about where they went. They went to him, and he was on the stinking rubbish heap outside the city. It was very costly to them. It would have taken them a long time, and it was gross to go and sit with them. I mean, Job was pretty gross himself, let's be honest. They went to him to see their friend in his agony. And if you have a friend who's really hurting, that is a great place to start. You might not know what to say, but just go to them. Don't expect them to come to you. Show them your love and your friendship by being present with them. I remember visiting my granddad in hospital when he was near the end, several years ago. And he was almost unrecognizable. You know, his skin had changed. He'd lost half of his body weight. He was quite a big man. But the hardest thing was his eyes had changed. See, all through his life, he did the Times crossword every morning over a cup of tea. And he'd normally finished it before he finished his cup of tea. He taught me so much about generosity, about what it meant to be a Christian in the workplace. He was a banker. He saw things in such a straightforward way. He could see right into the heart of something. But all of that, that brightness in his eyes, it was gone. Now, I'm sure many of us here will have had similar experiences when we have seen or visited loved ones towards the end of their life. That's what I have in mind when I hear these words from Job chapter 12. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. They were devastated. Their friend was so changed, they could barely recognize him. And they didn't know what to say. To be honest, I don't really blame them. Job carries on in verse 13. They sat on the ground for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Now, at this point in Job, sometimes people talk about what one of my commentators calls the compassion of a silent presence, which is more eloquent than words. The compassion, it's a bit poncy, isn't it? The compassion of a silent presence, which is more eloquent than words. And there is truth in that. Sometimes simply being with people is not only enough, it's the right thing and the best thing to do. And certainly once Job's friends do open their mouths, they show the truth of what my mum tried to teach me, which was if you can't say something that's true, helpful or kind, shut up. Still learning that lesson today, Mum, not that you're watching. But I'm not sure that what happened here was that good. It's a great example of looking closely at what's actually happening in the Bible text. First, verse 12, they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their head and wept aloud. This was to show sympathy, but it was also the cultural sign of mourning. It's what you did when someone died. Then, did you notice how long they were silent for? 7 days and seven nights. The standard period of mourning. Now, perhaps the mourning was for Job's children and the servants that we heard were all killed and all the other losses. But actually, the text suggests it was Job they were mourning for. As if he was as good as dead. Plus, to start with, I mean, silence might be a great place to start with someone. But for 7 days? Christopher Ashe put it like this. To sit quietly with a sufferer, to hold their hand, to listen patiently as they pour out their grief is one thing. But to refuse to speak a word to a sufferer for 7 days and seven nights is eerie and not comforting. 7 days silent, sitting there. But also, did you notice in verse 13... it doesn't say no one said a word. It says no one said a word to him. Now, I don't know, but it could well be that it might not have been silence after all, but just a refusal to speak to Job. And that's quite another thing altogether. But whatever the reason for their silence, Job was suffering and he was alone. His wife was there, his friends were there, but the image painted for us in these verses is of a picture of a man who is utterly, utterly alone. Now, I remember when I was single going on a holiday with a work colleague and her family. We'd been good friends. In fact, we were ex-work colleagues. They were renting a big house in Cornwall for her and her family, and each of their kids took a friend each, so there were nine of us in total. And they discovered when they got there that there was a little sort of attic room at the top. So she texted me and said, I don't suppose she knew I was on holiday that week, but I was just going to be at home. Do you want to come? So I did. And there were nine of us. There we all are. I'm the sort of one right at the top looking incredibly young. And there I am standing on a cliff with a couple of them, and if I zoom out a little bit, that's how high we were. Now, at the end of that lovely trip, it was a week on the Cornish coast, I drove home, and it was late October. So by the time I got home, if you've driven to Cornwall, you know it takes a long time to get home. It was late October, and it was dark when I arrived. So I had no food, so I went to the freezer, and I put a pizza in the oven, and I turned on the TV, and pew, there was a power cut. Except it wasn't my fuse box that had gone. The entire village was off. It was pitch black, utterly silent. The street lights were off. The TV was off, the internet was off, the mobile phone masts were off, so I couldn't even call or text someone. And I sat there in my house in the utter darkness, having had this wonderful week with these 9 friends, and it was awful. And that was just for one night. For some, the loneliness and suffering has no end in sight. I wonder how you might respond to someone you know and love who is really suffering. Some silence is good, showing your love by being there. But sustained silence is not good. So what might you say to Job or to someone else? What might you ask? It's probably worth thinking about some of those things in advance, because there will come a situation where someone might pull you aside and say, this really awful thing is happening to me, and you go, I don't know what to say. It might help you to think through what you might like someone to say or do for you in that situation. I suggest not telling them a story about how you know how they feel or how the same thing happened to you once. Please don't do that. Make them the focus, not you. Think about what you might like someone to say to you if you were in Job's position and visited by your friends. For the truth is, and it's a hard but important truth for all of us to learn, is that for reasons we may never and probably will never understand, sometimes God does take his children through deep darkness. After a week of no one saying a word to him, finally Job breaks the silence. In chapter 3, verse 1. Last week, you may have found it hard that Job, or 2 weeks ago, that Job worshipped God after all those awful things that happened. How could he do that? Well, now we hear some of his raw emotion. He doesn't curse God, he doesn't sin, but instead he cursed the day of his birth. Chapter 3 is not an easy read. These days, I guess we'd probably put trigger warnings on it. It's probably the darkest chapter of the whole book, and there's a lot of darkness in Job. I mean, listen to this. From verse 4, if you want to follow it along in a Bible, listen to all the words that Job piles on top of one another for darkness. That day may it turn to darkness, that God above may not care about it. May no light shine on it. May gloom and utter darkness claim it once more. May a cloud settle on it. May blackness overwhelm it. That night, may thick darkness seize it. This is not just dark, it's this thick, oppressive darkness that Job feels in his soul. Now look down with me at verse 11 to see the why questions that tumble out of Job's mouth. Why did I not perish at birth? Why were there knees to receive me? Why was I not hidden away in the ground? Why is light given to those in misery, life to the bitter of soul? Why is life given to a man God has hedged in? Why? Job feels stuck, trapped by God. Hedged in, he says, and he wishes he had never been born. He doesn't understand. He sees only darkness. And that phrase there in verse 20, he is bitter of soul. And he's full of inner turmoil. This is where Job 3 ends. Verse 25, what I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness, no rest, but only turmoil. I wonder if that is a feeling you recognize. Maybe today, maybe not today. I certainly recognize it myself. Job is exhausted by his grief, like when you have no more tears left to cry and feel utterly spent. That's where Job is. Yet this chapter reminds me of another man in turmoil, in a garden at night time, his three friends also silent. See, Job's restlessness foreshadows Jesus going back and forth between his anguished prayer and his silent, sleeping disciples in Gethsemane. For there we begin to see the vaguest hint of the seeds of hope, even within Job's darkness and turmoil. They are small. They're so small, they're easy to miss and very hard to find when you're in that darkness. But for all our loneliness, we need never be as alone as Job, because Jesus suffered and died alone for us. We're going to sing those words later. In the garden and on the cross, Jesus knew the full depth of human loneliness and suffering. On the cross, then, we have that agonized cry, the title of today's sermon, "Why have you forsaken me?" On the cross, Jesus did not only wear our sin and our shame, but our loneliness too. Sometimes God takes true believers through the darkness and turmoil of Job chapter 3 and beyond. But Jesus' promise holds true. I am with you always to the very end of the age. I'm going to end with a reading from The Horse and His Boy, the third of the Chronicles of Narnia. Although apparently it's the fifth one he wrote. The boy is called Shasta, and he grew up with a bad-tempered fisherman who treated him badly. And he runs away with a Narnian horse. It's a Narnian horse, which means it can talk, because he discovers that the fisherman isn't his real father and is about to sell him to an abusive nobleman as a slave. He has various adventures, and he meets many people. And in this passage, though Shasta has been separated from all his companions and he's lost, riding a horse, different horse, over a mountain pass in the mist at night. Once more, Shasta was alone amid the drip, drip from the trees. He remounted his horse and continued along the road he had chosen. Strange, icy winds kept blowing mist past him, though they never blew it away. If he'd been used to mountain country, he would have realized that this meant he was now very high up, perhaps right at the top of the pass. But Shasta knew nothing about mountains. Being very tired and having nothing inside him, he felt so sorry for himself that the tears rolled down his cheeks. What put a stop to all this was a sudden fright. Shasta discovered that someone or somebody was walking beside him. It was pitch dark and he could see nothing. And the thing or person was going so quietly that he could hardly hear any footfalls. What he could hear was breathing. His invisible companion seemed to breathe on a very large scale, and Shasta got the impression that it was a very large creature. The thing, unless it was a person, went on beside him so very quietly that Shasta began to hope he had only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly came a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. "Who are you?" he said, scarcely above a whisper.
"One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing. Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep. "I can't see you at all," said Chester, after staring very hard. Once more he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face. It said, "Tell me your sorrows." Chester was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his father or mother and had been brought up sternly by fishermen. And then he told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives, and of his night among the tombs and how the beasts howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and thirst of their desert journey and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them, and also how very long it was since he had had anything to eat. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least two the first night, and..." "There was only one, but he was swift of foot." "How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, "I was the cat who comforted you among the tombs. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new fear of strength, strength of fear for the last mile so that you could reach King Loon in time. I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came to shore where a man sat wakeful at midnight to receive you." "Who are you?" asked Shasta. "Myself," said the voice, very deep and low so that the earth shook. And again, "Myself," loud and clear and bright. And then the third time, "Myself," whispered so softly you could hardly hear it, and yet it seemed to come from all around you as if the leaves rustled with it. Shasta was no longer afraid that the voice belonged to something that would eat him, nor that it was the voice of a ghost. But a new and different sort of trembling came over him, yet he felt glad too. As the mist began to clear, Shasta knew the night was over at last. He could see the mane and ears and head of his horse quite easily now. A golden light fell on them from the left. He thought it was the sun. He turned and saw, pacing beside him, taller than the horse, a lion. The horse did not seem to be afraid of it, or else could not see it. It was from the lion that the light came. No one ever saw anything more terrible or beautiful. After one glance at the lion's face, he slipped out of the saddle and fell at his feet. He couldn't say anything, but then he didn't want to say anything, and he knew he didn't need to say anything. The High King above all kings stooped towards him. The lion touched his forehead with his tongue. He lifted his face and their eyes met. Then instantly the pale brightness of the mist and the fiery brightness of the lion rolled themselves together in a swirling glory and gathered themselves up and disappeared. And he could hear the birds singing, welcoming the dawn. Later that day, Shasta travelled back along the same path. Only this time, it was not dark. The path became narrower all the time, and the drop on their right hand became steeper. At last, they were going in single file along the edge of a precipice. And Shasta shuddered to think that he had done the same last night without knowing it. But of course, he thought, I was quite safe. That is why the lion kept on my left. He was between me and the edge all the time.